Welcome to Designing for the Greater Good, a health and safety in design podcast series developed and presented by the Canterbury Safety Charter and the Professional Services Working Group. My name is Paul Duggan, and I will be leading you through a series of interviews with leading professionals in the industry answering the following questions. What is health and safety by design? How can it be used? What are the costs and the benefits? And why have you not heard about it? Tune in to find out, is good design designing for the greater good? For this episode, I'm here with Tania Hayward from the Christchurch City Council, and we're looking at health and safety by design and operating expenditure. So, Tania, can you tell me a little bit about your role?
Thanks, Paul. My role predominantly is with the facilities management team at Council, and my portfolio covers the libraries and a couple of transport buildings for the Council. I look after the maintenance side of those council and other minor work packages as well.
Great. Tania, can you give me your personal definition of health and safety? What does it mean to you in your role?
Health and safety within the FM field, and especially from a personal point of view, is making sure that those people using facilities and or working on a facility or in a building or in a space are kept safe and able to go home at night. So we try and always think about that when we're doing health and safety.
This is a big part of your role then, is thinking about how people interact with a building and making sure that they are safe at all times.
Definitely is. And especially high-risk works for contractors, we definitely need to be looking at that aspect and checking off certain things before they start any high-risk works.
Mm-hmm. How do you interact with the design process as part of your role?
As part of the design process, we've definitely, for libraries, we've built quite a few new buildings over the past few years because of earthquake. So especially with our last build, we're heavily involved as a facilities management team with the safety and design aspect, and sat down with the project managers, designers, architects as part of that process to look at certain aspects of the building and think through safety aspects and what we needed to do to ensure we covered our bases for safety and how the building would be used by users.
And is this a fairly new process?
I believe it's been used widely outside of New Zealand. It was my first exposure to it for our last building that we worked on, and that was predominantly pushed by a project manager, I think, or a team that had worked in the UK previously, where safety and design was quite big.
Okay, so it's well established overseas then, but in New Zealand sort of in the last few years?
I believe so.
Mm-hmm. And does that create a tension, I guess, between the people who are designing the building, who obviously have a lot of artistic stuff they want to add to it, and you've got to look at it from, I guess, the construction and the maintenance side, and then sitting above that, I guess, is the big elephant in the room, which is the economics of a building. How are those tensions managed, sitting in a group, I guess, and discussing these things?
Definitely, you've got conflicting ideas, and when you're looking at design elements and making things pretty versus how am I going to maintain it going forward, it's not so much attention, it's almost you have to work with your design team to make sure they think through certain processes for operational use going forward, because they may be looking at aesthetics and not necessarily the operational use. So making sure that you discuss it with them as part of the design process and safety and design process is key, and that's what we found on our last project, that as we all got around the table, we had conflicting ideas at times, but I think everyone is on the same page where they want to keep people safe that are using those facilities.
I guess saying that architects are worried about aesthetics would be a little bit of an understatement in my experience. And so I guess this is more about education and an attitude that when they think about that is actually thinking about it with a wider perspective than they have had before. And is that something that they readily adapted to?
In this case, or in my experience, they seem to. There are a few hard no's when it came to certain aspects of a design, skirting boards, etc., which going forward for us is quite a big one. But from a design point of view, it was a hard no. But that doesn't impact necessarily on safety and design. It's just a key design aspect, and may put some economic pressure on us down the track if we go to do any repairs to them. But from a design aspect, no. So it was some of the items we let go and let the designs, the architects do what they needed to do. But other aspects that were key to the safety of the building and to the contractors, et cetera, we were quite hard on those to make sure that we had certain things like anchor points on the roof, et cetera, added as part of the package.
Mm-hmm. Tania, can you give a recent example of health and safety by design in a project that you have been involved with?
For one of our projects, we do have a site which is multi-storied with a central atrium. As part of that, we looked at the balustrading for each of the levels because they are open levels and looking into the atrium. And we're focused on the public use of that space, and we were quite concerned of the balustrade heights to make sure that we were looking at those because, of course, when you've got balustrades and balconies, in some cases people can use them for other things other than just standing next to, which we're aware of. So we made sure that as part of the design that those balustrades and balconies were of height that was fell under the consent. And also they were strong enough to hold
withstand
any issues that could arise. So definitely we've got glass balustrading right through that building. We've got C5 fixings and mechanical fixings. So it was definitely thought of from a safety point of view for users in that space.
Yeah. I guess it's easy to see the tension there where the architects and designers want a wow factor, which you want, you know, in a big open space and in a welcoming environment, and say, you know, this is really, really good. But, you know, you've got to focus on the, actually, we have a responsibility to keep people safe. And
yes.
I guess in that process, it was good that you were able to have those things in place at that stage. Were there any further issues for this particular project?
For that one, widely, not that I can see, but definitely from this, from the example with the balustrades and things, it has, we've had a slight issue within, so we're 18 months down the track where one of the balustrades has given way, the glass panes has given way and has shattered, so we've had to repair it. So it's part of the building, buildings move, it happens. I don't think it was any fault of anyone in particular, but it just happens. So it's just a matter of finding the best way to repair breakages like that.
So in terms of the health and safety by design process, obviously you went far enough to for public safety, but I guess, do you feel it could have gone a step further in looking at the maintenance aspect as well? Is there something you could have done differently or would do differently as a result of what has happened?
Definitely from a learning from this particular project, yes, taking that extra step and thinking 2 years, 3 years, 4 years down the track from a maintenance point of view. We thought we'd had that covered, but we didn't. We weren't involved in how the mechanical fixings would be in place for this particular balustrade. So we weren't fully aware or we didn't look at how we would pull certain balustrades apart to fix them and what impact it had on contractors from a height safety point of view. We knew that they'd have to have safety equipment brought in or EWPs to get up to certain levels, but we didn't think about the time and cost of contractors having to pull apart certain aspects of the building to get to fix one balustrade panel, for example.
So obviously, as part of the process then, the next building, I guess, you design, there's something, learnings that you can take and apply to other projects. And I guess that's a great incentive for the health and safety by design process, that as we get better at it, we are going to reduce operating costs further and further as we go down the line and make better buildings. Is that something you feel is, a benefit of the process?
Definitely. And as we've moved through projects, especially with my team and personally, I've learned from each build that we have done, and you add a layer of that learning to each of those builds. And you ask different questions each time because what's come up quite a bit is you don't know what you don't know. So as long as you've got a list going in the back of your mind or physically that you look at when you're doing the designs or getting handover from contractors, at least you can cover as much as you can for the aspects of the building.
I guess one of the pillars of the health and safety by design process is that the cost in the design stage is minimal if you can put it in there as opposed to retrofitting. So has the council had to undergo some retrofitting of buildings, I guess, in a post-earthquake environment and also a post-2015 health and safety regulation environment? And is that a significant cost to the council having to do that?
We've certainly had to plan capital spend based on certain needs and requirements. I am aware of a couple of buildings that are probably 5-6 years old now that we've had to retrofit anchor points, etc. too, because it's essential that we have anchor points in place for people working on roofs, etc. So we've worked through a couple of quite a few of our buildings, especially from the library's point of view, to install things like anchor points, especially because of the health and safety regulations.
Tania, in your experience, does a high building operating expenditure correlate with a high level of health and safety risk?
At times it can, but when you're prioritising your OPEX spend or operational spend, your focus would be on, if you had a budget to stick to, you'd be focused on the safety elements of the building and operational points of the building. So what would happen would be your nice-to-haves would fall off, so your redecoration of a space or some of your mechanical work that you could put off for a couple of years, that would be pushed out in favour of doing health and safety side or safety installations for your space, because predominantly that's where your focus is to make sure that you've got a usable and operational space for customers, i.e. members of the public, and a safe space for contractors to work in. So your costs, if you have to decrease budgets, yep, you focus on the needs to have and your safety aspects and your other items you push out for as part of your long-term planning.
So definitely you're of the opinion that doing a very robust health and safety by design process as part of any new building pays off really, really in the long term, that it saves you so much money more than obviously not doing that as part of the process.
Definitely. Picking up as much as you can as part of the project or design process is key, especially from a maintenance point of view going forward, and fully understanding what the design is going to cost you to maintain from a health and safety point of view and from an operational point of view is important because you getting surprises 18 months or 2 years down the track is not great, especially when you're in a position like we are, where we have to plan out our capital works, our long-term planning, our long-term operational works, things like that. And bottom line is we're working for the ratepayers, so we have to be fiscally responsible.
I guess if you cast the net wider than just the ratepayers and the City Council, I guess most commercial buildings, if we focus on them in Christchurch at the moment, the people who tend to use them and operate them are different probably from the people that build them. Is that generally the case? Does that disconnect create a, I want to build it as cheaply as I can, and then the operator wants to operate it as cheaply as they can as well. So does that create a tension, and can you see that some education in this space would be beneficial to, I guess, people building buildings and those that are going to end up using them?
Definitely, I haven't had any personal conversations with others in regards to that particular topic, but I can see, just looking at the new buildings around Christchurch, every time I go past a building, I think, oh, that's going to cost a lot to wash the outside of. If you've got louvers, oh, that's going to be pricey. So I think from an FM professional and design and architectural professional's point of view, linking the two teams in early on is key, and making sure those discussions are out there. I don't know if there's some way of forming a master list or some kind of a questionnaire for teams to think about when they're going into design process that architects can maybe look at, or designs team can look at, if FM teams aren't present, because they're not always in the mix when projects are first scoped. They may not even be a part of the project. They may not be part of the team or the owner's team, because you could have a construction team just building a building, and it's not until you've got tenants coming in and you've got FM professionals then linking in to that aspect. It could be that we have that type of, I don't know, knowledge base for design teams to work from.
It makes sense in terms of the whole health and safety regime in New Zealand. How it's changed is the idea of collaborating with the workers as part of the health and safety, because they're the ones at the coalface who have to undertake the risk. And I guess in design of a building then, it's important then to get the input of the people who are actually going to be using and maintaining that building as part of that process, for the very same reason, because they are the ones there.
Definitely. And collaboration, you've hit it on the head there. You definitely need that from all sides. It's not always the end users that have the know-how or the tenants that are going to be in that space, because they may not be have that knowledge or experience in the background. So having someone that comes in that can do a soft landing as such approach to either moving in or using the building would be amazing, I think, from an FM point of view. You do hear from time to time FMs talking that because of the design, this isn't working, things like that. But I don't think it's because they're trying to bag the architects or anything. It's just, hey, it would be nice to know these certain things before we got into the building.
Does the pressure have to come on the architects and the designers or on the clients? Where do you see the most benefit in terms of education?
Definitely the clients, to make them aware of that side of things from an education point of view would be great. Sometimes that's not their main concern, so it would go through all the levels as part of that project. So if your clients aren't aware of it or they don't want to be aware of it, then it goes down to your design team, your architects, your engineers especially, because your engineers are working in there. If it's not lighting and HVAC or external sidings of the building or EQ strengthening, then it flows right through the project team, right through to the project manager, because if the project manager's not aware of it either, then they can't pick things up and talk to the design team. When you've got the building starting to be built and you've only got a structure in there before you put any fixings or wiring or anything in.
Okay, finally, if you had a magic wand that you could wave into your space and make your job so much easier, you know, what would you, sort of, your three wishes to the genie, as it were, what would they be?
From our point of view, I know technology is coming thick and fast from an FM point of view. So you've got your BIM models and things coming in. They do cost money, but I think they are essential in going forward. So being able to walk through a building and see a building in 3D mode, that can help. Mm-hmm. It can help with raising further questions on how people use it. Mm-hmm. So BIM modelling right through and asset modelling as part of that as well would be great. And I know from a council point of view, we're starting to get into that space a lot more. I think from a design point of view and right from the beginning, I don't know if there's a key list or just some learnings for each or standard procedure for design teams that they think about future use of the building would be great, even just to think about it. And I'm sure they do as part of the design. Like you said, aesthetics, not always the key. It's great to have. It's great to have beautiful buildings. We all appreciate that. But always think about what it will cost and what the operational side of things are in the future for those people that have to maintain it. And it's not necessarily the FMs or the facilities managers. It's the contractors that have to go into that space and put themselves possibly at risk if they don't mitigate those circumstances around that. And I think that those two key points, I think, would be the best things, because you're not always going to get it perfect. It would be amazing if we could. You're always going to find a few issues and a few glitches within buildings. That's just the way they are. And because you've got so many different people working on them, you're always going to find that.
Hey, it's been fantastic talking with you. Really learnt a lot. And I think that anybody hopefully listening to this podcast maybe will learn a little bit as well and think about, you know, anything, that it's not just about the here and now. You've got to think into the future as well as part of the process of going through it. So hopefully any architects, designers and clients who are out there will take note of that, and we can look forward to, I guess, healthier, safer and better buildings in the future. So thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul.
You have been listening to Designing for the Greater Good, a health and safety in design podcast developed and presented by the Canterbury Safety Charter and the Professional Services Working Group. This is Paul Duggan signing off. Tune in again next time as we answer the question, is good design designing for the greater good?